The Cooper Heart Institute supports WHYY. Their multidisciplinary team of cardiologists introduces the new Watchman device, a minimally invasive treatment option designed to reduce the need for long-term blood thinners in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation, thereby reducing the risk of AFib-related stroke. The Cooper Heart Institute is a comprehensive heart care center with offices throughout South Jersey. Details at cooperhealth.org/watchman.
Philadelphia Congressman Chaka Fattah has more than a criminal trial to worry about. The House Ethics Committee is also investigating. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The question is, will an indicted congressman really want to answer inquiries from the committee with prosecutors listening? WHYY's Tom McDonald looked into what's happened before.
Congressman Fattah is accused of using federal grants and charitable donations to repay an illegal campaign loan. Washington defense attorney Stanley Brand says don't expect the House Ethics Committee review to be completed anytime soon.
Generally speaking, the prevailing rule has been that the committee will stay its hand until resolution of the criminal case. That has been the dominant precedent over the last, really, century.
Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington Executive Director Noah Bookbinder says the slowdown is at the discretion of the congressman's attorneys.
Defense lawyers in a federal criminal case, a complicated one like this, in many ways can dictate the pace of the case. They can make it move quickly if they want to. More often, if they want to explore every possible avenue to litigate the case, it could take a very long time.
Bookbinder says charging a member of Congress is becoming more and more commonplace, so prosecutors and defense attorneys have precedent to follow.
The one thing that I'd say that's positive coming out of this is that it seems like the Department of Justice, which for a while we felt was being very cautious in going after corruption among members of Congress, it seems like they're being aggressive and really trying to hold people accountable, and that's a good thing.
Despite calls for him to resign, Congressman Fattah says he'll stay on the job and run for re-election next year. Attorney Stanley Brand says it's likely neither the criminal case nor the ethics investigation will be resolved before voters decide whether Fattah deserves another term. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
President Barack Obama this week unveiled his new climate change initiative. Let's see how it's being received and could play out in Pennsylvania with State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips. Susan, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Susan, put this plan in perspective. What does it mean for Pennsylvania?
Overall, coal is going to be a big loser and natural gas is going to be a big winner in this plan. At the end of the day, natural gas is already edging out coal. There's a lot of power plants across the country that have converted from coal to natural gas recently or are on their way. And part of that is because the Marcellus shale gas in Pennsylvania helped make gas nationwide so cheap. So it's just it just made economic sense to change from coal to natural gas. And now there's even a greater incentive for states to encourage this practice because it's going to reduce their carbon emissions.
Though many make light of the notion of clean coal, yet natural gas is less than clean itself.
That's right. Natural gas is cleaner than coal. It burns cleaner than coal at the smokestack, about half of the CO2 emissions than coal. Pennsylvania is an interesting situation because coal, as you know, is such a big provider of jobs in Pennsylvania. It still has a lot of influence on the politicians here. But at the same time, natural gas is growing in influence, and at least from a carbon perspective, it looks a lot better when you're burning it at the power plant.
I imagine natural gas producers are pleased with this announcement.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously the coal producers aren't. The natural gas producers, you don't get as many emails from them as you get from everyone else. But when you actually talk to them, they will say, well, yeah, this could really be a benefit for Pennsylvania if the rest of the country is forced to burn more natural gas than coal. And, you know, what they'll say is, look, it's a flexible fuel. Solar and wind are great, but what happens when the wind doesn't blow? What happens when the sun doesn't shine? What the natural gas producers say is that the electric power system needs natural gas as a base power. So even if you do develop more renewables, they're saying you still need us. You still need natural gas.
What kind of emails are you getting from environmentalists?
Well, environmentalists are super happy about this because, like I said, it's the first time the U.S. has any kind of plan to reduce carbon emissions. Now, what a lot of environmentalists are concerned about is, okay, so you convert all these power plants from coal to natural gas, there may be less carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, but there's still carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere.
Is part of the enthusiasm on the part of natural gas producers predicated on their belief that prices will go up over time?
Sure. Well, I mean, natural gas producers, if they have more customers, the price of natural gas will go up. And they want more customers now because the price is so low. And so what one person in the natural gas industry was telling me yesterday was this clean power plan could be great for Pennsylvania because it's a new place. It's a new market for all of Pennsylvania's Marcellus shale gas if a lot of these coal plants across the country continue to convert from coal to natural gas.
To what extent has Pennsylvania already converted pre-existing coal plants or shut them down?
Dave, we got to remember that the reduction in carbon emissions started with the recession. A lot of this has to do with the economy. And a lot of the conversions from coal to natural gas had to do with the economy as well. So right now, you're adding to it this policy mandate that will create even more or more rapid conversions to natural gas. A lot of these coal plants will likely shut down unless they transform into clean coal, which is very expensive.
Susan Phillips, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips. Texas Senator and presidential hopeful Ted Cruz recently proposed a constitutional amendment requiring Supreme Court justices to stand for election in order to keep their jobs. On this segment of That's History, WHYY's Chris Cetullo and Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of history at New York University, discuss how Cruz is not the first politician to suggest this, and he probably won't be the last.
Welcome, Jonathan.
Good to be here as always.
Okay, Jonathan, our topic for this time is order in the court. And the feeling that one esteemed United States Senator from Texas feels there's a lack of order in our Supreme Court at the moment.
That would be Senator Ted Cruz, himself a candidate for the Republican nomination for presidency. And after the Obamacare and the same-sex marriage rulings came down from the Supreme Court, Cruz proposed that there be elections, retention elections at certain periods in which the voters could decide if they wanted the Supreme Court justices to remain on the Supreme Court.
Right. And of course, that triggered an immediate reaction.
Yeah. Disdain on the part of Democrats and I would say measured silence on the part of Republicans who probably realized that it was a non-starter but didn't want to make too much noise about it.
Okay. So, yeah, there was a lot of criticism of the idea as unheard of and ridiculous from Democratic quarters. But as an historian looking back at the history of complaints about the Supreme Court, you see the field littered with irony here.
Absolutely. And it's been a bipartisan theme throughout our history. Presidents on every side and parties on every side have tried to alter the structure and the composition of the court when they don't like what it's doing. Let's keep in mind that Article 3 of the Constitution is actually the most ambiguous and the least clear or explicit part of the Constitution. That's the part about the judiciary. And it really just says there are going to be courts. It doesn't actually say how many people will be on the Supreme Court. So between the 1780s and the Civil War, the size of the court fluctuated between 6 and 10 people.
So Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt, two of our universally acclaimed greatest presidents, each of them had some problems with the Supreme Court in their time.
Absolutely. I mean, when Lincoln was elected, let's remember that the Chief Justice who swore him in as president was Roger Taney, the author of the Dred Scott decision, which upheld slavery. And in his inaugural address, Lincoln made a direct broadside at the Supreme Court. And I'm just going to read it because I think it's an astonishing statement because it sounds so much like Ted Cruz. Lincoln says at his inauguration, "If the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by decisions of the Supreme Court the instant they are made, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers, having to that extent practically resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal."
Okay, so now let's go to Teddy Roosevelt. What were his problems with the court?
What happened was Roosevelt, of course, steps down in 1908, and after he comes back, he decides he wants to be president again, but there's already a Republican president who's running again named Taft. So Roosevelt runs on the Progressive Party ticket. And during this time, the Supreme Court starts to strike down some of the trust busting and other economic regulations that Roosevelt had proudly signed during his time as president. So while he's running for president again in 1912, he says, listen, these decisions the Supreme Court are making, they should be subject to popular vote.
Okay, now let's fast forward to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who famously tried to pack the Supreme Court.
The court strikes down a huge number of his New Deal legislation, and Roosevelt is frustrated and frightened by this. So he proposes, since a lot of these Supreme Court justices are old, that after you get to be 70, if you don't resign, he can appoint somebody else up until six new justices.
Mm-hmm.
This creates an enormous amount of political blowback for Roosevelt, including in his own party. But ironically, after the court packing proposal, the Supreme Court starts to actually uphold some of his legislation.
Right. The general sense is he accomplished his mission without having to do that constitutionally dubious thing.
Indeed, indeed. Lost the battle but won the war.
Well, that's Jonathan Zimmerman. I'm Chris Satullo. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks. It was fun.
In today's headlines, Katie McGinty is making it official. She's running to represent Pennsylvania in the U.S. Senate in 2016. The Delaware County Democrat stepped down as chief of staff to Governor Tom Wolf last month after high-ranking Democrats lobbied her to run. In a web video, she frames her bid for Senate as a way to continue working with the governor. McGinty has also served as secretary of the State Department of Environmental Protection and an advisor to the Clinton administration. She faces former Congressman Joe Sestak in the primary. The winner will take on Senator Pat Toomey. Delaware transportation officials are seeking public comment on a proposed update for road projects over the next 6 years. In releasing the proposed capital transportation program today, officials said more resources are needed to keep up with aging infrastructure, noting some 45 projects in the current plan lost funding in at least one phase of the project. Delaware lawmakers raised motor vehicle taxes and fees this year, all to generate around $24 million annually to help pay for road maintenance and construction. 90 degrees, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:18. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Partly cloudy overnight, falling back to 70 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, Wednesday's high 88. A few clouds roll in on Thursday. There's a chance of a stray shower, high 82 degrees. Count on rain Friday, high only 78. Saturday, partly sunny, though the day could start with a leftover shower, high 82. Still ahead, a new teacher gets set straight.
One of my students completely called me out on it. Told me he had seen this movie 1,000 times before. The young Caucasian was going to come into an inner city room and inspire his kids with words.
But this burnout story leads him back to the classroom. That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Eastern University supports WHYY. The College of Business and Leadership programs educate and empower students to lead in the global marketplace, offering MBA programs including management and health administration, as well as both a master's and PhD in organization leadership. Eastern believes the world responds to those who believe and do. Their programs are designed to empower students to develop skills that impact the world around them. Eastern.edu/CBL. Eastern University. Don't just be, do, and wake up the world.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. Laura Marling leads the pack of Britain's folk music scene. Next time on Q, she drops by to perform from her new album, Short Movie, and talk about how she lost her passion for music and what brought her back. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Next time on The World, a Hiroshima survivor wants to keep her memories of the atomic bomb alive. Her granddaughter in Colorado wants to help. She knows her grandmother's stories, but her friends in America do not seem to be interested.
If I speak up to talk to America, they just don't care.
Stories of Hiroshima 70 years later, that plus the news on The World.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. In Philadelphia, public school teachers drop out at a higher rate than students. 70% leave the profession in their first 6 years. WHYY's Laura Benchoff offers this story of one teacher who left, taking a detour on a double-decker bus, and then ended up back in front of a blackboard.
Now, if you look out to your left, you can see the beginning of the Ben Franklin Bridge there.
Tim McAleer's day job is part stand-up comedian, part host to hordes of sunburned tourists aboard Philadelphia sightseeing buses.
Now, the Ben Franklin Bridge, really impressive piece of architecture, but it does have one major, major design flaw. What's that? It's blue. It connects us to New Jersey.
It's a pretty big departure from his last job as a middle school English teacher in West Philadelphia. McAleer's family had pressured him to go into teaching, but it took him a while to get there. Eventually, McAleer did get a teaching certificate. Almost immediately, a mid-year fill-in job opened up in Philadelphia in a Catholic school.
I had an eighth grade class. I was their third teacher. They had run two other teachers out before me. My first day teaching came in all inspired. I was going to change the world.
That feeling didn't last very long.
One of my students completely called me out on it. Told me he had seen this movie 1,000 times before. The young Caucasian was going to come into an inner city room and inspire his kids with words. And then he compared me to Michelle Pfeiffer.
That is, Pfeiffer as an ex-Marine turned inner city teacher in the 90s movie Dangerous Minds. McAleer kept teaching for 4 years, ending up in a charter school in West Philly. But something wasn't working. He wanted fiercely to help his students with their struggles. But when he tried, it backfired. One time, he got close to a family of 9, 7 kids and 2 parents squeezed into a 2-bedroom row home. One day when he visited them at home, when he knocked on the door,
their 16-year-old daughter came with a blanket wrapped around her, shivering, because the boiler was broken.
The family huddled around 2 small electric heaters in the house's 2 bedrooms just to stay warm.
Just the thought of how dangerous that is.
McAleer went to his charter school's CEO and asked if the school could help the family. She assured him that they would.
The following morning, she contacted the principal, who then contacted Child Welfare Services. And I remember after that, asking the 5th grader if he was hungry. And he said no. And I said, would you tell me if you were? And he said no.
He decided teaching wasn't worth losing his students' trust.
I realized that the things that I wanted to do, the reasons I became a teacher, I couldn't necessarily do.
The next summer, he quit teaching and took a job as a tour guide. The bus route starts in Center City and stops by all the famous historical sites, Betsy Ross House, City Hall, Logan Square. But it also carries McAleer across the Schuylkill River into West Philly, which for him is full of reminders of what he's really inspired to do.
Now, my favorite mural is in West Philadelphia, a 2-story mural of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
In 1967, King came to Philadelphia and gave a speech to 7th and 8th graders at Barrett Middle School.
The speech was called, What is Your Life's Blueprint?
Number one in your life's blueprint should be a deep belief in your own dignity, your own worth, and your own somebodiness.
Dr. King challenged the young men and women in front of him not to let the issues of systemic poverty they face overtake them.
If you can't be a highway, just be a trail. If you can't be the sun, be a star. For it isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are.
Even as his career took a detour, McAleer never stopped thinking about how to keep working with students. He started tinkering with the idea of a nonprofit that would help kids through literacy training, mentoring, and a pay-it-forward focus on service. And he started pitching his idea on tours so effectively that some tourists started lining up to help him. One even built the website for his new organization called Teach to the Core. Eventually, McAleer landed in front of Jim Burnett, executive director of West Philadelphia Financial Services Institute. Burnett decided to take a chance on McAleer and his idea.
We've taken a chance on a whole lot of folks. So far, Tim and his team at Teach to the Core have been everything that we've expected them to be.
McAleer and 2 reading specialists now tutor students in a program Burnett runs called West Gold Fellows.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, so the last, sorry about that. The last page, mm-hmm. You're going to be, as you read through Huck Finn, you're going to be pulling words out that you don't know and filling them in the last page. Sorry.
Gotcha.
Whether or not Teach to the Core will become viable as a nonprofit remains to be seen. But for now, McAleer is back where he wants to be. And although he's working for free, he still says he's getting a big payoff.
I want kids to remember me. I want kids to look back one day and say, this guy had a hand in where I am. I get a lot out of it.
For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
The Philadelphia site where the traveling robot known as Hitchbot was supposedly destroyed is close to Elfrith's Alley, the oldest residential street in the nation. As the internet rages on about how exactly the bot was dismembered and by whom, residents of the narrow cobblestone alley in Old City are ready for the craze to be over, as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Ted and Sherry Watson are longtime residents of Elfrith's Alley, and here's their first reaction to the Hitchbot story.
It was found on 2nd Street, the bench on 2nd Street, not on Elfrith's Alley.
They say the colonial brick, old shutters, gas lights, and hitching posts for horses are all fine to come look at, but
we do not mistreat robots.
That's absolutely right.
Ted and Sherry Watson say they're quite accustomed to tourists pointing cameras and phones at the front of their home.
Yeah, they open the mail slot and they jiggle the latches on the shutters and pound on the glass. No, they're really generally very nice. The most frightening thing usually is 40 Japanese standing outside your front door when you walk out.
They say they're fine with tourists asking about the alley or their 18th century house. But the last thing they want to have to field questions about is the robot's demise. That's where Chester County artist Dan Mitchell steps in. He made a big painting of Hitchbot with bright colors and stood by it near the fateful bench on 2nd Street. Then a police officer stopped by.
He said, oh, is this the place where the robot got mugged? You know, and I said, oh, yeah, it is. And he said, are you going to light some candles for him? I said, probably tonight. You know, we'll have a little memorial for him.
In the meantime, the robot's remains are on their way back to Canada. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
We are the robots. We are the robots.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. When you think of colleges that are sports powerhouses, Haverford College isn't typically at the forefront, and tomorrow we'll hear how graduates of that mainline school have been filling baseball's front offices. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
We are the robots. We are the robots.
Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers Camden MBA degree allows for specializations in critical areas such as finance, international business, marketing, entrepreneurship, and others. Evening and Saturday classes are held at the Rutgers Camden campus and Camden County College. An information session is on Wednesday, August 5th at 6 p.m. at the Rutgers Camden campus. Learn more at mba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-6452. The Rutgers School of Business, Camden. Expect more. Be more.